With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hello and a warm welcome to Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. I'm Joe Haddo, and it's so wonderful to have you with us for what is going to be, I can already tell, one of my favourite episodes of this podcast. Today I'm joined by two legends of the literary world who'll be going head to head in a war of the words a little later on. My first guest is the author of many novels, non-fiction books and stories for young adults too. In 1992, she won the Pulitzer Prize for her novel A Thousand Acres and has also received the Penn Center USA Lifetime Achievement Award, but she doesn't look it. Jane Smiley, hello and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. That's very kind.
I always think if you get a Lifetime Achievement Award, you know, you think, well, I'm still living the lifetime, you know. But anyway, we'll get to that in a mo. Go on.
I was just going to say, it's a California organization, so they don't expect you to be very interesting when you get older.
Well, we will make sure that we address that in this podcast. And to my second guest, who's a writer, broadcaster, entertainer and poet, whose collections include The Works, You Made Me Late Again and Up in the Attic. Many of her poems are in school textbooks across the world. In fact, I grew up on reading many of them. And she has performed for Her Majesty the Queen, not once, not twice, but three separate times. She's recorded six incredibly popular series for my dad's favourite radio station, Radio 4, and is one of the very few guests who has appeared on Desert Island Discs more than once. I am, of course, talking about Pam Ayres, MBE. Hello, welcome to you.
Oh, hello, Joe. Thank you very much. Well, that's a very nice introduction.
Well, it's an absolute pleasure and honour to have you both with us for this podcast. It really is. And we are connecting California, I believe, Jane.
Yes.
With London, I believe, Pam.
Well, I'm in a village called Maisie Hampton, which sounds like something out of The Archers. And it's
right.
It's about 70 miles out of London in Gloucestershire.
So we're not connecting. Well, I'm in London. I suppose we're connecting to me. But
yes.
So it's Gloucestershire, London, California. That's pretty good, isn't it, for the old tin cans
and string. That's an exotic blend, isn't it?
Yeah. And Jane, how is that Californian sun this morning? And how do we find you in this sort of weird and strange world that we're living in at the moment?
Well, it's actually very sunny. It's a little chilly at the moment, but I'm sure, I mean, sometimes the temperature goes up by 20 degrees in the course of the day, 20, 25 degrees. So it looks beautiful out the window. We'll see what it's like later. We could use some rain, though. I'm sad about the rain.
I'm pretty sure we could send you some.
Oh, I wish.
I love California, and I love the temperature there, because I would be very happy living my life in shorts and a t-shirt and
some flip-flops most of the time. And I always, whenever I'm over there, I just sort of in bliss that I don't have to think about what I'm wearing. You just throw on a t-shirt and you're fine. And then a lot of the Californians, you know, who live there, look at me and think, oh, aren't you a little bit cold? And I'm like, nah.
About 5 years ago, I was down in Riverside, which is in Southern California, and I was walking behind four people, a guy in shorts and flip-flops, a woman in a puffy jacket, me in a sweater, and somebody else in just a t-shirt. So, yeah, everybody disagrees about what the temperature is.
Yes, they do, very much so. But for most people coming from the UK to California, we think it's hot all the time. And Pam, how are you in your Arches-like village? Everything okay?
Yes, actually, it's a very nice time of year. We're just seeing the first suggestions of spring. The snowdrops are out. The hawthorn's starting to come out on the hedgerows. The daffodils are starting to come out. And it's got a wonderful feeling of something all ready to pounce, you know, that the spring's getting all ready and the sap is rising and it's all going to be lovely and we'll come out of the gloom and everything will be bright and colourful. So it's a really lovely time of year and I'm very interested in nature and I've got two ponds here and the newts have just come back into the ponds. They go off into walls and crook and little nooks and crannies during the winter time, and then at the right time of year they all go back into the pond and mate and lay eggs and such like, and they've all just come back into the ponds now, so it's a lovely time of year here in the Arches.
Fantastic. In the Arches, yeah. Well, we've got a heron that keeps coming to visit our pond.
Oh, you won't have many newts then in that case.
No, so I think maybe the newts are still hiding because he definitely visits on quite a regular occasion.
You need to put a section of drain pipe into your pond so that they've got somewhere to scuttle into so the heron's dagger-like beak can't get them.
Ah, that's very good advice. Maybe we'll look at that, yeah.
Yeah, a section of drain pipe is what you need. A section of drain pipe. And then they've got somewhere they can get, you know, they're not vulnerable.
Yeah. And it's a weird one because we love watching the heron, you know, fly in and watch them sort of stalk around. Mm. And yet we're also thinking, oh, don't eat everything.
No.
Because we want to keep, you know.
They are extraordinary birds. My father always said they were as light as a feather. If you actually picked one up, even though they're big, gawky birds, he said they are feather-light. And I think the bones are hollow, aren't they? They're very light birds indeed.
And those legs must weigh nothing because they're like little twigs, aren't they? Mm.
That's fascinating.
It is, isn't it?
I could bore you all about newts for some length of time.
we'll talk more about newts a little later on.
Well, we could talk about geckos.
Yeah, I spent some time in Singapore and that was the first time I heard the term gecko. And they were all over the ceilings and the walls then with their little sticky feet.
Yes, they're fascinating. I petted one about 3 or 4 months ago. It was walking across the fence, you know, that board that goes along and holds the fence up. And it paused, and I just sort of reached out and petted it on its back, and it kind of glanced up at me and then walked on. Oh. I thought, boy, you're not afraid, are you?
No, I like people who pat geckos.
Well, I didn't know that we were going to be talking about nature quite so much, and I'm sure we will continue to do so, as well as talking about books and writing, what you've both been reading recently, and of course we'll do the book off a little later on. First though, Jane, I want to talk to you about this new book that you recently published. It's called The Strays of Paris. It's your latest novel. It features a set of heartwarming friendships that develop on the streets of Paris. So perhaps you could tell us just a little bit more about this story.
Well, it begins with a 3-year-old racehorse at Auteuil Racecourse who's just won a race, and she happens to the trailer has left, taking four horses. It's going to come back for her, And the groom who's waiting with her has gone off to the bathroom. And so she is looking out at the grass, and she's just so interested in it, the turf it is. And so she happens to press her chest against the door, and whoops, the door opens. And so she walks out, and she's drawn by the green grass, and then step by step, she ends up in the Place du Trocadéro, which is on the west side of the Seine, up the hill. Very beautiful spot. And it would go from there.
And what was it that drew you to write about Paris specifically, and also to write sort of about these animals?
Well, Paris in the book, Perestroika, is based on my own horse, Perestroika, who is a very curious horse. And she's just the sort of horse I can imagine doing something like this. And I had been, it was in 2009, and I had been visiting an American woman who trains racehorses and actually has quite a good business in and around Paris. And then we had gone to the Place du Trocadéro for some French onion soup. And I said to my husband, wow, wouldn't it be fun if the horse escaped or a horse escaped and came here? That would be really fun. So I added in a dog because, you know, she would need some kind of guidance. And then bit by bit, it all sort of fell into place. And it was really a lot of fun to write, I have to say.
Yes, I can imagine it was, actually. I sort of got that sense from reading it that it probably was. I want to come back and talk about the fun you had with it and also the sort of escapism of the book in just a moment. Pam, if I could come to you, though, to talk about Up in the Attic. Now, this is a collection published a few years ago now, 2019, but it's featuring on the World Book Night list for this year, which we'll come to in a moment. But for those that may not have got to this collection yet, perhaps you could tell us a little bit about it.
Oh, yes, Joe. Well, Up in the Attic is my latest collection of gems. and it covers all kinds of subjects, anything that I thought would be fun to write about or would strike a chord with people. So I've written lots about animals. It takes its title from the title poem is Up in the Attic, and it's about going up into the attic and seeing all those things. Well, probably everybody's more efficient than I am, but I tend to hoard things. And so up in my attic, I've got my baby's pram, and I've got all sorts of bits of furniture and old clocks and things, and they've all got a story, and it's not a very nice feeling. Although you are under the same roof as the rest of your home, which is warm and cozy and welcoming, up in the attic it can be very different, very chill and full of memories and old bits of carpet that you thought you'd use and you never actually did. And I've got my daughter-in-law's wedding dress in a big box up there that she asked me to store, and those things which are not entirely comfortable to look at.
Yeah.
And then I suppose one of my favourites is I Am the Dog Who Bit the Ball, which is about one of my grandsons who, on his fifth birthday, he said he would like a red football, and it actually took quite a lot of tracking down, because you can buy footballs and you can buy a red ball, but you can't necessarily buy a combination of the two, you know, a proper football, which is red. And so in the end, I had to go and order one from a sports shop. And I always find those fairly terrifying because the assistants are always ripped. And anyway, I went and ordered this football, and I had to wait for it a little while. And when it came, you know, I was so pleased, and I gave it to my grandson for his birthday, and he took it out on the lawn and kicked it. And I have a small dog, and the small dog ran after it, jumped up, bit it, and immediately it deflated and was rendered absolutely useless. And so that's the kind of thing that I like to write about, because I think it strikes a chord with other people. And so I wrote the poem I Am the Dog Who Bit the Ball, and he's been sent indoors and he's in trouble.
I'm guessing it's a Jack Russell Terrier.
Absolutely, Jane. Yes, that's precisely you're spot on. That's exactly what she is.
We had, and it's a female, we had a Jack Russell Terrier who went between two slats in a fence, ran on a limb and killed a bird.
Oh dear. They're very mischievous, aren't they? They are mischievous little dogs, but very lovable.
Oh, I adored them.
I know, I adore mine. I she's my companion and little shadow. Shall I give you would you like me to read a little bit of I Am the Dog Who Bit the Ball?
Oh, let's have a burst, yeah, please.
Oh, please, okay. Yeah.
I am the dog who bit the ball and ruined the game of goals. I wasn't to know that balls don't go if you've added a couple of holes. The kids and dad, they all went mad. They sent me indoors, they did. The ball was new, a beautiful blue, and it cost them several quid. The shame, I ruined the game and made the family crabby. I jumped for it, I shook it a bit, and it went from hard to flabby. Bad dog, they said, go in your bed, and in disgrace I go. I offered a paw, but nobody saw, nobody wanted to know. That's a little bit of it, so you can see what a tragic piece it is.
And what's lovely about your poems, Pam, is that they channel something very British, and you find the funny in some very like small things. And yet what you're saying about, you know, going up to the attic there is universal, and talking about a Jack Russell. And I imagine that actually, you know, the Britishness transcends to a worldwide audience.
Well, it's interesting that Jane's little dog is just as mischievous as mine. You know, I do like subjects with the universal appeal. So I tend to write about children and pets and feeling things that make you feel embarrassed when you don't feel as good as everybody else. And it's quite nice then, because I can write about a situation in which I felt embarrassed or humiliated. And then people say to me, oh, I felt just the same. And it's nice. It's very nice.
Yeah. I want to come back and talk about World Book Night shortly, Pam. It's a celebration of reading that takes place every year. And it's something that I absolutely love. And I always try to champion as much as possible when I can. So we want to talk to you about that. Coming back to The Strays of Paris, Jane, because when I read this book, I felt like it had a sort of fable-like quality to it, if that's the right description, and I just wondered if that was sort of deliberate on your part.
Well, I wouldn't say so, because I don't think I had any intentions in terms of form. I think all I wanted to do was to play around with the animals, explore. I love Paris, so explore Paris. I think the West Side is really an interesting area. And so I just wanted to make the animals believable, or at least plausible. I had to include some people, and it just sort of built itself. So I can't say that there's a fable aspect to it, but it is true that I was prodded to put in some sort of bad guy at some point, and I just couldn't do it. I said life is the bad guy. Too bad, you know. All these animals and people have their own issues and they have their own problems, and I'm not going to bring in somebody with a gun. So,
well, I'm so glad you didn't, really, because
I think
we all need a bit of escapism at the moment, don't we? And literature is a way to get it.
Yes, I agree.
I want to talk about what you've been reading recently, talking about finding the time to read, and it's not always the first on everyone's list, but for many writers, obviously, reading is, you know, most writers are huge readers, and we love nothing more than curling up with a book. And I love asking my guests what they've been reading recently, and also whether, you know, there's anyone or any book that they'd like to champion and just tell us about. So what about you, Pam? Have you been sort of delving into books in the last few months?
Absolutely, yes, I have. In fact, it's a good thing you can't see me, because I look very tired, because I sat up late last night to finish the book that I have been reading, which is Hamnet by Maggie O'Farrell, which I absolutely loved. It's such beautiful writing, and it's about it's a fictional account of Shakespeare's son Hamnet, and it really brings to life Stratford-on-Avon in the 1500s, what people did, what they ate, what they wore, what they thought about, what medicines they had and didn't have. And it was so rich. And I cried. I had a good cry as well. So I felt as though I really got my money's worth. And then
it sounds
yeah,
like
and
it.
Then before that, the book I read before that was The Girl with the Louding Voice by Abby Darre, and that is a wonderful book as well. It gives you an insight into life in Nigeria if you're very poor and subject to those terrible traditions and the way women are kept down and generally treated. So that was fascinating. I know it's massively popular, but I can only add my praise to all the reviews. I just loved it. And the other one I read before that, which I loved as much, it possibly if not more, was Where the Crawdads Sing by Delia Owens, because I'm very interested in nature and the wonderful story. She's woven such a wonderful story against a background of natural history and all the kind of creatures that existed in those Louisiana swamps. It's a wonderful invention and creation. I'm just awestruck that someone can write so beautifully.
What a great set of recommendations. And do you know what, not that it's about me, but I have read all those books, and actually we were lucky enough to have two of those authors, Maggie O'Farrell and Abby Darre, on this very podcast in
series.
Yeah.
Oh,
so
gosh,
I wholeheartedly agree with your recommendations, and yeah, you can go back and listen to those episodes anytime you like, Pam.
I will. Thank you.
And what about you, Jane? What have you been reading recently that you've enjoyed?
Well, I teach at the University of California at Riverside, and I've had two undergraduate classes for the past 8 to 9 weeks. So I've mostly been reading what I assigned.
Mm.
But one of the books that I assigned was The Fountain Overflows. So that was a reread for me. And it was interesting to see how my students responded to it. They found the language complex, but they were willing to get into it and they enjoyed it. The one that one class read most recently was The Boy in the Field by Margot Livesey. And they quite liked that. They liked the way she showed how discovering the boy who's been stabbed in a field outside of Oxford changes all three of their lives in different ways. They liked that. And the other one, the one that I'm reading right now, which is also for, and this is also a reread, but this is also for school, is The Joy Luck Club by Amy Tan. And I think I read this maybe 10 years ago, but it's just so fascinating the way she explores these women in their lives in China and then in San Francisco. And she goes into such great detail, and it's really fascinating.
Wow. And The Fountain Overflows is the Rebecca West novel, is it?
Mm.
Yeah.
Yes, I assume that everybody in the UK would know that.
Well, honey, I've made assumptions like that and been very wrong. So I just thought I'd double check.
Thank you.
No, and there must be a great feeling of power that comes with, you know, being the lecturer and having, you know, being able to set the texts. That must feel great because, you know, you can each year go through your collection, or you can think about books that you've enjoyed and go, oh, I fancy that one again.
Well, I like assigning the books, and I like rereading them or reading new ones. A new one that I read and assigned was Leave the World Behind by Ruman Alam, and that is about a mysterious sort of end of the world event seen through the eyes of people who don't know what's happening, and he never tells you what's happening, so it's pretty scary. But you know, you never know if the students are going to like them, so there's no sense of power about it. they get to say what they want and what they like. And sometimes they like odd ones and sometimes they like the same ones that you like. And I'm always interested in their opinions.
How lovely to be guided through literature. I feel very envious of your students, Jane, because there's so much out there, and to be knowledgeably guided through and alerted to things that perhaps you weren't aware of. I didn't really have a very good education. I mean, the teachers I had did their best, but it wasn't much of a school, really. It was massively overcrowded just at the end of the war, and some of our school was in an overcrowded old building, and then some of it was in an old marine camp, and some of it was in a displaced person's camp. It was a funny old education, really. And the idea of being guided through the great mass of books that's out there by somebody knowledgeable and kind and saying, try this and try that, and what do you think of the language in this? I feel filled with envy, really.
Oh, that's very kind of you to say. I think the university that I work at is incredibly diverse. And so I make it a point to make the reading list very diverse.
Yes, yeah.
When I was growing up, we read mostly English books from the UK, with the occasional, you know, Nathaniel Hawthorne or something like that, which I truly appreciate and I thought was very formative for me. But at the same time, my students really need to read about their own cultures, and they need to read authors that reflect some of their own ideas and their own views. And so I try to make the reading list as diverse as I can.
How interesting.
Well, I, in contrast, think I had a really great education, in the sense that I was brought up reading Pam Ayres. So that's how.
Oh. Oh, you old flatterer, you. Well, thank you.
Well, no, I mean, I was saying it for slight comic effect, but I do also mean it. Do you get something out of the rereads, Jane? You know, you said these texts you read 10 years ago, and are you sort of a champion for the reread? Because I know so many people who don't do it because they think there's too many books in the world, and why reread one?
I really like rereads because you notice different things. I think in The Fountain Overflows, this time I really noticed that the point of view was from a young girl and therefore very limited. And the way that she perceived her parents fascinated me as a parent. I thought the father got off with not much, condemnation by the daughter. I thought it was just chaotic and a good reflection of West's childhood. And I just liked it a lot. But it was different the last time than this time.
Yeah, there are books I've reread. I would say I'm not a constant rereader, but there are books that I have enjoyed and go back to again and again, you know, and actually do get something out of. And interestingly, poetry is something that you can read and read again. And I think possibly because of the form and because that they're a bit shorter than obviously a novel. But, you know, rereading a poem is quite commonplace, I think, isn't it, Pam?
But sorry, Joseph, what's the question again? Sorry, I went off on a bit of a mental tangent there because I was thinking about books that have made a big impact on me. And one that I didn't mention to you before was one called No Friend But the Mountain by Behrouz Bouchani. And it was about a man who was trying to get... He's now in New Zealand. I think he's lecturing at one of the universities in New Zealand, which is wonderful, because he wrote this book about being a refugee and trying to get into Australia, and they put him on that terrible island in a camp, and the detail of what it was like and the unbearable boredom and all these men crowded in together. No Friend But the Mountains by Behrouz Bouchani is another one I would like to mention, because it completely changed my view of the people who were trying to, you know, who were were trying to get a decent life and a job and a bring up their family safely, and how pitiful it was for him. Yeah, so that was a stunning book, I thought. Anyway, sorry, what was your question, Joe? I was drifting off on a bit of a mental tangent there. Ask no, me the question worry. Again. Sorry.
I was just talking, I was just reflecting on the rereading thing of books and how actually in poetry it's quite commonplace, isn't it, to reread and that for them to be performed. And I think that's because the form lends itself to that.
Well, I'm a performance poet, and before COVID I was doing lots of performances around the country. In fact, when COVID really clamped down, I was in Australia. I was doing performances. Well, I'd done one performance in Sydney, and I had performances in Adelaide and Perth, and they were all cancelled, and we just got home as quickly as we could. So when it comes to rereading, I have to reread mine a lot because I've got to learn them. You know, I don't want to read to people. I can't bear that. Because if I don't know the poems, then I have to put my glasses on and get my book out and stand at some lectern, you know. And I like to be a performer, and I like to act the poems, you know. And if I'm reading The Dog Who Bit the Ball, I want to be the dog, and I want to look ashamed, you know. I want to put my best efforts into acting the thing. And so when it comes to rereading, I do a lot of that so that I know I've got them in my mind before I go out and perform them to an audience. As far as rereading novels and other books are concerned, I am of the school that thinks there are so many thousands out there that perhaps I shouldn't, instead of rereading one that I've already read, I should go on and read a fresh one and so try and cover some of the ground.
Well, that's true. I think it's split.
Yeah, I think it's a dilemma there. I mean, one of the ones I was going to mention is I, Tituba by Marisa Conde, which I bought 3 or 4 years ago and was just sitting around my office, and which is a mess of books. And I picked it up and I started reading it, and I just thought it was incredible. It's from the point of view of an enslaved woman during the Salem witch trials who was put in jail. And it's completely believable and fascinating. And that's one that I just had lying around, and it was wonderful.
What's it called again, Jane? It sounds amazing. I'd like to read it. What's it called?
You want to read it. I Tituba, Tituba, Black Witch of Salem.
Thank you very much. I Tituba, thank you. I shall look.
It's good. It's like a sort of global book club, isn't it?
I know.
Yeah. I'll send you a copy if you send me your Jack Russell Terrier.
Oh no, I couldn't part with her. I'm afraid.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
You were talking, Pamela, there about being a performance poet, and obviously before this horrible pandemic that's sort of ruined things for everyone and has been very sad, but which we're hopefully seeing a sort of end to. You would have been touring, as you mentioned. And one thing that I think we have in common is that we've both been on the Queen Mary 2.
Yes. Yes.
Quite a ship, isn't it?
Yeah, the Queen Mary 2. Yes, it is. It's huge, isn't it? It's a great big thing.
Well, I'd never been attracted to a cruise, let's say. And I was very lucky enough to go for work, and I actually went with the late great Sir Terry Wogan on one of its early voyages, of the Queen Mary 2, and I got lost in the thing, Pam.
Yes, I can believe it. It was vast.
I didn't know what I was doing.
Oh.
I mean, have you been on one of these big liners, Jade? These are these sort of massive cruise ships that have 2 swimming pools and 5 restaurants.
Well, I have been on some cruises. I'm not sure I've been on. I haven't been on one that crosses the Atlantic or anything. The best one I went on was one around the Eastern Mediterranean. So we went to all kinds of interesting spots, including Venice, of course, but maybe the weirdest one was the Palace of Diocletian in Split, where I could, you know, I'm very tall, I'm 6'2", and I could barely fit in the hallways. It was really weird.
Oh.
But it was a fascinating thing. And basically, the cruise ship was your hotel, and then you spent all the rest of the days exploring these sites.
Mm. I quite like the idea of cruising, where you just get on and you find a nice comfortable room, and then you unpack your case and that is it, and you don't run the risk of leaving things behind, as I once did in Las Vegas. I was doing some filming. We were traveling across I don't quite know why I was in Las Vegas, to be honest. We had done a film. We had made a film. No, I think my husband was desperate to see it, you know, and go and look at it. And I had a lovely gold fountain pen that my husband had given me, and I left it behind in a hotel room in Las Vegas, which was heartbreaking. And so I like cruising because you only unpack once and then everything comes to you. I like that. And for me, it's much more of a challenge to work on a cruise ship. I mean, I like it because I like the travel, but it's not as if you are appearing in a theatre where people can look at the various things that are on and think, well, I like that, I'll go to that and I won't go to that. If you're on a ship, the audience who come are not necessarily fans. They, you know, they just come because you happen to be on that night, and so it's much more of a challenge. But it's an interesting challenge, and it usually goes well, because everybody likes to laugh, don't they? I'm in the business.
Yes.
I'm in the business of hoping to make people laugh, and when you are successful and you see an audience throw itself forward and a great roar of laughter, it's so satisfying to have done it from, you know, to have completed the arc, if you like, that you thought of the idea, you wrote something, you learned it, you went out and put it across as best you could, and everybody fell about laughing. It's thrilling.
And you may like the fact that you can just unpack once on a cruise ship. I like the fact that when you come back from the bar and you're flopping from side to side against the walls, you can blame it on the fact that you're on the waves and that you haven't had several glasses of gin.
Well, I wouldn't know. I'm a very clean living person, you see.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Well, it's time now for the book off. And this is where each of you is going to tell us about a book that you absolutely love, that you think me and everyone listening should read. You're each going to get 3 minutes. You don't have to use the 3 minutes if you don't want to, but I'll be putting you on a timer. And when we reach those 3 minutes, even if you're still talking, I'll either be ringing you out with the school
crumbs.
Bell, or I'll be honking you with the horn. So,
how rude, how very rude.
It's incredibly rude of me, and I have definitely got into trouble before on this podcast by sort of cutting people off in their prime. But Jane, would you like to go first or second for the book off?
I would like to go second. I need inspiration.
Oh, I say. She's going to see what you're made of, Pam.
I'm not sure I can provide any, Jane. I'll do my best.
Right. Which means, Pam, you get to decide if you would like the school bell or the horn.
Oh, the school bell, please. The horn sounds a bit coarse.
Yes, it is a bit, isn't it? Okay, yeah. Well, I'm putting 3 minutes on the clock for you, Pam. And just before we start the timer, what book are you putting up for us?
The book I would like to talk about is An English Pastoral by James Rebanks, because I love it.
Fantastic. Well, there's 3 minutes on the clock then. We will not interrupt you. It's over to you to tell us about An English Pastoral.
I met James Rebanks, who wrote An English Pastoral and A Shepherd's Life, among lots of other things, 2 years ago. And I met him when I was speaking in the august surroundings of the Royal Geographical Society at an anniversary celebration for an organisation called the Countryside Restoration Trust. And their aim in life is to farm and produce food, but to do it alongside nature, so that you farm and you produce food in the way that you have to on a farm, but that you live alongside nature. And one of their properties is called Lark Rise Farm, and I went there, and it's very beautiful, and it's full of hares and birds, and the hedges have been allowed to grow up, and they're full of crab apples and hazelnuts and blackberries and sloes and rose hips and all kinds of natural food. So what they do, I greatly believe in. And James Rebank's story, well, it's not really a story, his book, An English Pastoral, is about three generations of his family who farm a fell farm in the Lake District. And it's about what went wrong, really. He describes his early experience of farming with his grandfather, about having little fields and how each field grew a different crop, and how they looked after the land and how it was full of life. And I love the book particularly because I experienced the same thing. When I was a child growing up in the village of Stanford in the Vale, it was full of life. There were voles, water voles, in all of the rivers, and you could go out and get a basket of mushrooms or a basket of blackberries, and you could go fishing and buy little, and you could catch trout and you could catch crayfish. It was seething with crayfish, and there was just food everywhere, and there was a wood near us which grew bluebells and hazelnuts, and it's just a wonderful place that smelt gorgeous. And then suddenly it all started to disappear. The bluebell wood was uprooted. I went there one day, and the whole thing had been uprooted, and all their roots, all their silver roots, were up in the air, and the wood had gone, and all the little fields started to be ploughed up. The little field, which was full of flowers that we used to gather for my mother, was suddenly ploughed and growing a crop, and everything changed. And in James Rebank's book, he explains why and how it happened, and how pesticides and fertilizers were introduced to farmers as the answer, that they would no longer be subject to the vagaries of the weather and all the pests that came to bother. Oh, blow, I was just getting going there.
You know what's so awful about doing this this book off is that some authors come on and they wrap it up in two and a half minutes, and they sort of do a bit of a mic drop out there, like, yeah, I've said all I need to say. And then there are others like you, Pam, who are just, you know, you start getting into it and I can tell that you've got so much more to say, and yet I'm hovering over the timer thinking, oh, I'm about to ring out Pam Ayres.
Do you think it gave them a sort of gist of the book, though, what it was why I like it.
I do, and we will talk a little bit about it in okay. 3 minutes' time. We're going to let Jane do her pitch, and then we'll come back and talk about both of them. So you have a breather.
Okay.
I think that was really great. And I'm going to put 3 minutes back on the clock for you, Jane. Before I start it, what book are you putting forward for the book off?
I am going to talk about The Year of Lear by Jane Shapiro, which is a nonfiction book about 1605 to 1606 in London and thereabouts.
Well, I've put 3 minutes back on the clock then. It's over to you, uninterrupted, to tell us about The Year of Lear.
When I was growing up, we read a lot of Shakespeare plays, but Shakespeare the man never came into it because there wasn't much information about him, or at least nothing that they told us. So when I read this book, I was totally amazed. Shapiro is a Shakespeare scholar at Columbia University. And what he does is he starts with the summer of 1605 and goes through 1606 to the first production of King Lear in, I think it's just after Christmas in 1606. And he talks about all the events that happened in that year and a half, including a plague, including a rumored assassination of the king, which turned out not to be true, including, just so many things with regard to what Shakespeare would have been doing. Maybe I have several favorite parts, but maybe my favorite part is at the very beginning, where he starts you at the corner of the two streets where the house Shakespeare lived in was, and then he has you follow Shakespeare down the streets to where he is going to buy a copy of this old play about Lear, the one that he's going to repurpose. And since I repurposed King Lear for 1,000 Acres, that obviously was interesting to me. But he just follows he follows the personal implications of all the political events that are taking place. He also gives us whatever we seem to know about, or seem to have found out about, the people that Shakespeare knew, about the players, his fellow players, about what they said, about what they thought. And one of my favorite episodes or chapters is sort of toward the middle of the book. It's called Equivocation. And he does say, though the scene in the second part of Henry VI would be the first time Shakespeare so explicitly employs what would come to be called equivocation, it would be far from the only instance of this verbal trick to appear in his plays. One of the great pleasures afforded by his works is watching his many lovers, rivals, servants, avengers, and villains equivocate, sometimes playfully, sometimes in the most cunning and destructive ways imaginable. And he links that to all of the political chaos that was taking place, and how everybody had to give their opinions in tricky ways.
Oh, no, that's me cutting you off as well now, Jane. And I know there was so much more.
At least I got the word tricky in.
You did. And I thought I got a sense of these books very much from both of those pictures. And thank you both for them. Pam, I have to say, you know, the moment you started talking about Lutrise Farm, I think it's called, I just wanted to go there. My goodness.
Oh, it's wonderful. Yeah. Place. And what I didn't get in my 3 minutes was the fact that it matters to us all. It's not just about farming as an isolated thing. The fact that we look after our ecosystems, and the fact that we care for the life around us, is so important to us in so many ways, and it has been allowed to What I didn't tell you, which I did want to include, was that in about 1962 or 63, when DDT had just been introduced as a kind of a seed protector, when I was going to work on the bus, I saw this big field and it was littered with dead birds. There were hundreds and hundreds of birds that must have eaten the seed treated with DDT and died a terrible death. And that first alerted me to the fact that something was terribly wrong. And James Rebanks, in his book, goes through the glory days, if you like, of mixed farming, and then how it went wrong, how it was rather seduced by chemicals and fertilizers and pesticides, and now this wonderful movement to try and not turn the clock back, but to redress the balance and to look after our ecosystems.
Well, I should say that when I was writing 1,000 Acres, the inspiration for setting King Lear on that farm was driving through the north central part of Iowa, which had been a swamp, and which they had immigrants from Norfolk had created these wells that drained the water and out of the plant. Drained the water out of the soil. But by the 1980s, there was a terrible pesticide crisis. And that's one of the things I wanted to talk about too, because the pesticides were going down into the drinking water and they were poisoning people and nobody would admit it. So yes, I think this is an issue that should be compelling to all of us, but
I know it's just, I mean, when you think about photosynthesis, the fact that there's all these little plants have tiny pores in their petals and stems and leaves, and they breathe in the carbon dioxide and they breathe out oxygen. I mean, it's so miraculous. And why wouldn't we look after them all?
So true, isn't it? Yeah, it sounds like a fascinating book. It really does, Pam. And so does The Year of Lear, if I'm honest, Jane. A very different book, of course, but James Shapiro sounds like he knows what he's talking about. And I love this idea that he's just taken a sort of, you know, 12 to 18 month period of Shakespeare's life, and the way you described, you know, him as the reader following Shakespeare down the street to find that play and repurpose it just really sort of gave me a sense of what the whole book is about. And interesting that Pam mentioned the Maggie O'Farrell book, The Wonderful Hamnet.
Yes. That is interesting, isn't it? That we both should find that so interesting. Of all the hundreds of books that are out there, that we should both have found one that features Shakespeare, the man.
But I do think there is a sort of such a fascination with him, and I know that there's been many books about him and there has been sort of a lot written and films and everything, but Jane, the sort of appeal of Shakespeare and the interest in him never seems to go away.
Well, that's true, but when I came back and was looking at The Year of Lear, which I read a few years ago, I realized that the world that Shapiro is depicting is quite similar to the crisis that we're having now with all these, especially in the US, but with all these political fights and these terrible possibilities, and then the return of the plague, and so this illness, and how it how they have to close the Shakespeare Theater in London and go on the road, so their income becomes a little iffy. I mean, it just struck me when I looked back at it again. I said, wow, things just keep coming and coming and coming.
That's so true. I hadn't thought about it in that sort of context of being...
No, it's... Yeah. How interesting.
Well, I have to say, I loved both of those pictures. I'm sorry that I cut you both off. And
We forgive you.
I'm honestly very, very keen to read both of them. But I've got to pick one to take home on behalf of the listeners. That's the game. Both very strong. But I think just by a little inch, I'm going to take An English Pastoral Home.
I'm not surprised.
I think it's... I think it's also, and Jane sort of helped me out by saying how important it is that we're all, you know, talking about this, and the ecosystem is so important and we should know about it and learn a bit more about it. I think it is a very relevant book, and I would
Oh, well, great. Thank you both very much. I think you're both being very gracious. I will just say that the thing that stayed out in my mind when I went to speak at the at this celebration of the Countryside Restoration Trust was a man called Derek Gow, and Derek Gow is very knowledgeable about wildlife and ecosystems, and he stood on the stage and he said, people talk about ecosystems in this country, he said, and there are none. He said, there are just a few shreds like cobwebs blowing in the wind. Mm. And that image was so sad and disturbing to me, the cobwebs blowing in the wind. Yeah. So I'm very honoured that you have chosen the book that I nominated. Thank you both very much.
Well, you're very welcome. And I've also written The Year of Lear now on this ever-growing list, Jane, of books that I have to order and read. So thanks very much for bringing it to our attention.
It's extremely readable. It's kind of like, it's just, you just zip through it. It's great.
It sounds great. Yeah, it really does. Two fab recommendations, and another two fab recommendations for you listening. The Strays of Paris by Jane Smiley, which is out now. It's published by Mantle. And Up in the Attic by Pam Ayres, which is also out now. It's published by Ebury. And it's part of the World Book Night list. So remember, to find out more about this year's World Book Night, which is happening on the 23rd of April, visit worldbooknight.org. And I think from the 23rd, you can download a free digital copy of Stories to Make You Smile, which is a specially commissioned book of short stories from a load of best selling authors. So that's something free that you can download and enjoy at home, which is pretty amazing. And that's all thanks to the Reading Agency, who do such amazing work. And I said earlier, Pam, I always want to sort of champion World Book Night. I want to make sure people know how much the Reading Agency do for, you know, literature and for getting books into the hands of readers. You're in pretty good company as well this year.
Well, absolutely. Yes, I'm very honoured. I always think we had a teacher at our school called Miss Edmonds, and I was nuts about ponies like many, many young girls. And we had a poor little library. It was on one shelf, but we were all invited to go round when this library was opened. And she gave me a book called Wish for a Pony by Monica Edwards. And I often think what would have happened if she hadn't given me that book, because I absolutely loved it. And then I devoured everything I could find by Monica Edwards. And then she gave me the Just William books. And, you know, that little library was so important, and it just showed me what worlds you could step into.
It really does. And I think hopefully there'll be some stories like yours on the 23rd of April of people putting a book in someone's hand and that starting a reading journey for them as well.
I hope so.
It's been an absolute pleasure to have you both on the podcast. I wish we could have done it in person, obviously, and I wish we could talk for hours more, but I will let you go. Jane and Pam, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you.
Goodbye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.